Session number 7257.
Mr. Lane, tape 10. After you were wounded and you returned to England after the first day of the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917, how long were you in England?
Well, altogether, I was away from the Western Front for about 9 months. I returned to France about the end of April 1918. We had heard all about the German advances and were astonished that they'd got so far. And we sort of wondered what had happened. But when I reached the base at Boulogne, I think it was, we were told that we were not going to the Hertfordshire Regiment, we were going to the Bedfordshire Regiment. Well, the Bedfordshire Regiment was, of course, the regular regiment, which had two or three battalions of the, which covered Hertfordshire, really. You see, Hertfordshire itself had only our battalion, 1st Hertfordshire's. I had no objection at all to going to the Bedfordshire Regiment because it had quite a good reputation. And but of course, as usually happens, quite a number of the people who'd been in the Hertfordshire Regiment for some time did object violently. When I say violently, they couldn't do anything about it, but they were very, very angry about it, really. And I remember one of them asking the sergeant major at the base, who was an old ex-marine, middle-aged fellow, soaked in rum, I should think, by the look of him. When he was asked this question, his reply is unprintable. To go to another regiment and wear your own badge. But of course, it was so stupid, you see. Anyway, we had to go, of course, and we went to the 7th Bedfords. And the 7th Bedfords was, I think, at that time, commanded by the colonel, a young colonel, only 28 years of age, and we joined them at somewhere in front of Elbeer. Now this was now getting on for, well, toward the end of May, I suppose, and we went into the line with the 7th Bedfords. After a short period, we were told that the 7th Bedfords were going to be amalgamated with the 2nd Bedfords. The 7th Bedfords were a Kitchener's Army Battalion. The 2nd Bedfords were a regular Army Battalion. And I was very glad to get back into a regular Army Battalion again, and a regular Army Company, because although by that time quite a lot of the old soldiers had gone, there were still quite a few left. And the organisation and discipline was still there. Anyway, I had to be reduced. It was a practice in those days to reduce yourself to, or to be reduced to private again. On joining anything under sergeant, which was reduced to private. So I had to become a private again. And I carried on like this, but within about 6 weeks, I was Lance Corporal. And then within another couple of weeks, I was full corporal. And I really did enjoy myself, well, not enjoy myself, but I did feel happier in the 2nd Bedfords than I'd felt in the Hertfordshire Regiment in my last 6 months of that regiment, when it became part of a territorial division. Anyway, by that time, this was getting on now, and the German attacks were more or less over, and it was our turn to start attacking, which we did. And the biggest attack of all was on the 8th of August. But I wasn't in that attack because I'd been in a local attack previously and was carrying a box of small ammunition across from our front line to their front line when a ricochet bullet, or rather, I suppose it was a ricochet, must have been, hit my tin helmet, and sent me sprawling into a shell hole. Well, at that time, the second beds were wearing shorts. It was in the summer, you see. You know, the commander, you know, that was his idea, that we'd wear shorts in the summer. Well, I fell into this shell hole, and my left knee was very badly cut, lacerated, really, is the word, by German barbed wire, which was different from our barbed wire. In other words, once again, it was more efficient. Instead of small sort of hooks, small ends, pointed ends, it had very often an oblong spade affair with a sharp end to it. It was more formidable to look at anyway than the English barbed wire. Anyway, as a result of this laceration, I was sent down to the casualty clearing station because you've got to be, it was all very, you know, an infection, it was like a wound really. And before I knew where I was down at the base again. Anyway, it didn't fester, it cleaned up very nicely, and after about 6 weeks I was back with the battalion again. Well, we kept advancing, and eventually I've mentioned about this night attack, haven't I? Well, that goes on for that night attack, you see, we made this night attack. Then we occupied this wood, we were attacking, during this night attack we had advanced quite a long distance, and eventually I found ourselves in a small village. German dead soldiers were lying around about. They had been killed not so long ago, and there were still civilians living there, and we were billeted there for quite some time. I think that was the last attack we ever made. I think the armistice came not so long after that.
You mentioned earlier the United States troops.
Yes.
Did you yourself see them at all? Did you meet?
Well, only that
American?
Once, when I told you that the three or four men of the United States Army were bringing, this was on the Somme, I think, were bringing German prisoners along a road, and we were advancing. Not, I didn't see any Americans advancing, but these Americans were bringing these troops down. And the Germans were shelling, well, I suppose they were trying to shell the road, but they were falling about 50 or 60 yards away from the road, which to an ordinary infantryman with any experience wouldn't be regarded as particularly dangerous. But immediately the first shell came over, I've said this all before, these American sentries or guards who were guarding the German prisoners immediately lay flat on the road. The German prisoners stood at attention, as it were, looking down at them, which struck us as highly comical. You can't guard a prisoner by lying on the road or leaving in there. You could have got to your rifle or anything else and got away quite easily. They didn't attend that, of course, and that was it. That's the only time I saw an American once. He came into our front line. This was before they were really taking part in any attacks or anything. He was an NCO, and I remember soon after he got in the front line, there was a fairly heavy bombardment on our front line, which often took place. And I remember him saying to me, "Good God," he said, "is that what you have to put up with?" I said, "Oh, well," I said, "it's, yes," I said. "Of course, our men wouldn't stand that." I said, "Oh, yes, they would. Of course, no, anybody would think that first time in the line. You'd think, oh, God, I can't stand that." Anyway, that's what he said to me. And I thought, "Oh, yes, they would." I said, "They'll stand it. They'll get used to it." And that's the only time I ever saw any Americans.
Was it good for morale when the Americans came into the war, do you think?
Well, we knew that they were coming. I think it must have helped quite a bit, really, because there's no doubt that we were getting at the end of our tether, you know. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the people that have got the experience were getting tired and nerve-wracked and that sort of thing. And the youngsters really didn't know what it was all about, you know, the younger people. And we were running out of troops. We were using boys of 18 and a half, you see, or just over that. And I think myself, it's only an opinion, that if the Americans hadn't come in, it would either have been stalemate, in which case, because the Germans had had enough too, and there would have to have been a negotiated peace, that's what I think. But the fact that there are these Americans, thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, strong, healthy lads, well equipped, their strength hadn't been impaired in any way, they were ready to go just as we were in 1914. You can just imagine what the Germans thought of it. Anyway, they must have known, they knew what was going to happen, you see. That was why they were so desperate to capture Paris before the Americans got established over there and could take part. But other than that, I didn't see any Americans at all. But I'm sure that it had an influence, a profound influence on the outcome of the war.
Did you also feel, when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred, were you aware of the implications of
that? Oh yes, we were aware of that. We knew that eventually that would release thousands, hundreds of thousands of German troops. But we never thought of that. You see, your life was so precarious anyway. You only could live from day to day, you see. You never thought, well, in a few months' time, they'll be after us, because we didn't expect to live all that time. And we didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, we only lived from day to day. And the general strategy, if there was such a thing, it didn't seem to us that it was very effective, and we knew nothing about it. We trusted our generals to a certain extent, but of course we really didn't know what was going on. They were living in luxury in Saint-Omer, I think, at first, and then somewhere else. And you never saw us. Do you know, I think I've said that I saw, now, the Earl Cavan, who was the Guards Brigade, 4th Guards Brigade commander, while we were at Givenchy, he was only a little chap, he used to visit the front line every morning. Every morning. And the only other general I saw was that General Daly, who I told you about. That's the only time I've seen a general in the front line. They may have been, but as far as I was concerned, they never visited the front line. They couldn't possibly have known what it was like, and they wouldn't have been so stupid. They couldn't, because our generals, you know, very often they try to outdo each other. If you got to an area, say we were transferred to an area where it was nice and quiet, you did get areas like that, you see, you know, just a bit of sniping and so, but and the French did it quite a lot. Immediately, generally, the Brigadier General would stir things up. He'd start shelling the Germans, you see, even though he knew perfectly well that at that game the Germans could beat us every time he would do it. That was for his own glory, you see. It's human nature. I mean, you can't blame him, really. It's how people go on. There was many a place where we could have saved hundreds and thousands of casualties by simply leaving them alone, because if you're not going to make if you're not in a position to make a real attack, if you're not superior to them, there's no point in stirring them up. It's like a small dog going for an Alsatian. That's the same. And it happened time and again, but I understand that the French didn't, and the French, and when the French were facing the Germans in many, many parts of the line, they simply live and let live until they had to attack properly. See, then of course it's that. There was no point, but they got an idea that you must show an attacking spirit, you see. You've got to show that you were attacking, you were not there to just look at them, you were there to kill them. Every no good Hun except a dead one, that was a story. I don't know whether I told you about this trench on the Somme, which was one of the worst trenches I ever saw. Not because it was dangerous. Shall I carry on about that? We took over this trench. It was somewhere near Thiepval, somewhere near the Schwaben Redoubt. This was in the it was very hot weather, It was the end of the summer, of course, and this trench was full of dead Germans. And they'd been there some time. Some were sitting on the steps of these deep dugouts, which went down 20, 30, 40 feet underground. Sitting there, some were lying in the trench floor, on the trench floor. We'd seen plenty of dead people before, but we'd never seen any like this. They were all bloated. They were different colours, pallid grey, green, black. You know, that's how they go, you see, a corpse goes in time. And they get blown up, you know, gases get blown, they get blown up with gases, you see. And it's a funny thing, you know, you'd think that you couldn't possibly eat anything. But we didn't take any notice of it. We thought it was funny, really. It just shows you how your mind can get inured to such situations. Of course, we used to eat our bully and all the rest of it, and we started making up the trench, and we had to tread on one of these bricks. He was partly buried, and every time we trod on this where he was lying, his tongue would come out. This caused great amusement amongst our people. And, of course, they were dead, so it didn't matter. I mean, once you're dead, so that... Well, I mean, we learned that philosophy anyway, that when you're dead, it doesn't want... You know what's going to happen to your body. We already knew that. We knew what happened, because we'd seen numerous bodies flung up. Even in civilian churchyards, early in the war, he shelled this village, and the coffins were turned up. You know, that was quite earlier. So we become acquainted with death quite early, and it didn't make any impression on us, really. But we were frightened. Don't you imagine that we weren't frightened. We were terrified at times. Terrified under shell fire. Everybody was, pretty well. Some people could contain it better than others, but some people just couldn't. They'd run along the trench like a frightened chicken, you know. Well, I was frightened. Good God, I was frightened enough, but I knew that there was no use running either way, because you might run right into it. If a shell came near you, he wasn't going to put it there next time. You were much better off staying where you were. But anyway, that was a trench that... and that was a time when we really were starved. They couldn't get the food up to us. And in we got this trench... we didn't bury these people. We were relieved after a time, so that somebody else had to do that. But we made it into a trench so you could use it as a defence system. And we went down in some of their deep dugouts on our next tour of the trenches. And it was a revelation. There were, as I said before, there were hospitals, well, not hospitals, but beds with sheets in, men lying dead in beds, you know, in a lovely sheet, white sheets. And we were so hungry at the time, the food was there, but they couldn't get it up because of the shelfer. And we found a sack of German flour, I always remember that. And we took this sack of flour, it wasn't about the size of that table, the amount in it anyway. We took it back to our front line position, and we boiled it up in water, and at that. And we'd been so thirsty there that we've actually drunk out of shell holes, which God knows what a shell hole container might. It very often contained either parts of a human body or human body. It might contain anything. But we'd been so thirsty, we've drunk that water. I have anyway. Cold, without boiling it, because you couldn't get a fire very often. But that German underground system, no wonder they are. And yet it seems to me that our people, before the attack started, they couldn't possibly have known what was happening there, because if they had, surely they never would have. Because all the Germans had to do, they kept most of their men down below. Their machine gunners would be in a position, and they only wants one machine gun to hold up a battalion, you see. Now, what's all this nonsense about spies and agents? They didn't know, did they? And it seems to me that our people, even before the war started, they could have had very little knowledge of the German army. And it was the same with the Navy, because the Navy was superior to ours in many, many respects. You know? So I never look at a spy story, because I think it's all a lot of rubbish anyway. They seem to me to go in for things that that of no importance anyway, nobody knows anything about it. Well, take the Falklands War. I don't think our people knew anything about the Exocet missiles. Or they would have kept those ships away from me, you know. And so I never look at a spy. I just can't stand them. Anyway, that was the position on the Somme. And we used to, as I say, we were really half-starved for about 2 or 3 months. They couldn't get food up to us. And we used to eat the old patties and this old German flour until it was all gone, and I was too glad to get it.
Oh, yes.
Can you think of any other sort of major health problems that you might have had?
Well, of course, venereal disease was one of the problems. And in fact, quite early in the war, the Earl Cavan had the whole battalion on parade, and he told us, this was about 1915, I suppose, early in 1915, that there was such a large number of men in hospital with venereal disease. He did quote the number, which I think ran into thousands. And he told us, he spoke to us in these words. He said, it is all right getting home to England with an honourable wound, but it's a different story if you get VD and a disgrace. And he warned us about this, you see. Well, now, so far as I could see, it was only a small proportion of the troops who were likely to get the disease, because it was only a small proportion who visited these red lamp areas, you see. But of course, well, I should think it might have come to 10%, you see. And in fact, in our battalion, or in our platoon, I knew 3 or 4 who got it. And had to go to hospital. Well, of course, it was a very serious thing in those days, you know. But, of course, people were more afraid of it in those days because they knew in Victorian times all these things were hidden up or tried to be hidden up, or in Edwardian times. They weren't mentioned amongst the upper classes anyway, or they weren't mentioned in newspapers and that sort of thing. But most people were afraid of this complaint because of the horrible stories you heard about, you see. And not only that, most people had a higher standard of morals in those days than they had now. I'm not saying that intercourse didn't happen. It did, of course, between girls and boys and that sort of thing. But I'm quite convinced that if the standard of morals had been the same as it is now in this country, that is to say, the permissive society, more than half the British Army would have gone down with venereal disease. I'm quite sure of that. Anyway, that was the thing that prevented it. And it was the same people every time. You see, probably oversexed people. I'm not blaming them for it. But anyway, they got quite enough punishment without being blamed for it.
Would they have picked it up in
France? In those red lamp areas.
And they were well provided, were they?
Well, there was... you'd only find... In Béthune or Béthune, you'd find one or two red lamp areas. And you'd see people lined up there, you see, because in Béthune, at any time, there'd be several thousand troops, you see, quite apart from your own battalion. And I believe in those days that they used to... If a man was married,
I believe,
or it was rumoured anyway, that they stopped his wife's separation allowance if he had venereal disease. And I believe it's true. But I believe there was such a row kicked up about it that later on they had to rescind that order and give them the allowance, you see. Well, the only other thing that I was going to say... Well, no, I don't know. This is a general observation, really.
Well, I'm just going to make a general observation about the attack, which is called the Battle of Passchendaele, which started off, and where I was wounded the first day in the afternoon, so that I can't give any personal, I had no personal experience of the battle after that. But we do know from books that it was carried on, in spite of the fact that this was the ground here was waterlogged within no time of the rain falling, and that troops had to haul their equipment and their ammunition over this ground right up to November 1917. And we are told that many troops were drowned through falling off the duckboards. They put duckboards down, but of course and you had to do all these movements at night. You couldn't possibly do them in the daytime. Well, what I'm trying to say is this, that not long after the Battle of Passchendaele was over, we made a very successful attack with 400 tanks at Cambrai. I've never had it explained to me why, when our staff could see that this Passchendaele affair was hopeless, and they'd only wanted one or two to go up there and see that, and was simply slaughtered in vain, why we didn't stop there as soon as the rain started, switch our troops and guns to Cambrai and use them in the attack there. Because if they'd have had another 3 or 4 divisions on that attack, they could have got right through, you know. Now, have you ever heard that explained? I've never heard that explained. And nobody can tell me that this advance to Passchendaele was worthwhile, because I'm quite convinced it wasn't. In other words, in nearly all our advances, we lost more men than the Germans did until the end of the war, until the last 6 months, 5 or 6 months. And if they could do that so soon as the end of that attack, transfer or get divisions, if they've only stopped the Cambrai affair, Passchendaele affair, in about, as soon as they realised that it was going to be hopeless, switch the troops and the guns over to the Cambrai sector and use them there with the 400 tanks, and there'd be many more tanks they could have used, because many were lost at Passchendaele, you know, many tanks. What a place to put tanks anyway. Well, that's all I wanted to say about that. But it's only a...
Did you find there was a lot of resentment at the time, though, for this?
Our people, you know, it's surprising that... I didn't think much of it. I didn't realise it at the time. A lot of this really has come since, you see. I mean, I wasn't mature enough to realise then, to raise these questions, you see. And I'm sure none of the... Most of my battalion were just ordinary working people like myself. Well, I was a bit better educated, that was all. Most of them worked in, from my particular company, the gunpowder factory, or the nurseries, you know, the greenhouses in the Lee Valley. Or there was Nobel's, who got a big factory there, my friend worked there. Do you know, this is another instance of the attitude of the troops. My friend ran a machine at Nobel's at Waltham Abbey before the war, and he earned more than the average working man earned, because he could run this particular machine, which was apparently rather difficult. He came home wounded. He was wounded at Festubert. He went round there to see some of his old friends. They immediately asked him whether he would come and work their machine again, because it kept breaking down and they couldn't get anybody to work that machine. They said they could get him out, they could get him on the, you know, the retired, not the retired, the job, the sort of rare job, the job that could only be done by an expert. You said they could get him onto that and get him out of the army. He flatly refused. He's sitting up. I don't think I could refuse that at that time, but he did. Went back to France again.